It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back in on Monday. Coming up, Indiana passed changes to its controversial religious freedom law yesterday to include language barring discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity under that law. First, it's time for a weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Ovshinsky. And one of the biggest stories of the week, the Senate Majority Leader proposed a new plan to fund a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks. And the UW system was also in the news this week after President Ray Kross said there may be changes to how the system handles tenure for professors. Cover those stories and more right now with Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. Okay, so this ongoing story, we've been covering it for a while over a potential new arena for the Bucks and some other uses. New developments this week.
Yeah, basically there are some competing proposals that are floating around, and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald is the latest to float a proposal, and it actually involves the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands. Under Fitzgerald's plan, this new Bucks Arena would be financed by this Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, something to the tune of around $150 million, with the city and county coming up with an unspecified amount of additional money.
This affects the Milwaukee area in particular. Any word from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett on this?
Yeah, so Tom Barrett said this week there were elements of Fitzgerald's plan that he liked, but that he actually still preferred Governor Walker's plan, which was released several weeks ago. Barrett says the key question is how much, you know, will, when it's all said and done, how much will the city and county be on the hook for as far as this new arena? And Fitzgerald's plan doesn't really address that with any sort of specifics.
And Governor Walker, this plan was part of his big budget release earlier this year. This is one of the parts of the plan that legislators have not embraced warmly, to say the least. But give us the gist of what he's looking for the arena.
Right. So the governor's plan is a bit larger than Fitzgerald's, and the role of the city and county is a bit more clear, I'd say. It's a $220 million plan, and the money would be raised through traditional bonding. And would leave the city and county with a bill of around $50 million or so, which Barrett says, he is confident that the city and county could pick up at the end of the day.
So this new plan centers around the Board of Commissioners of Public Land.
Yes.
Not a household phrase.
No.
What is that?
Not in mine, at least. Isn't it? Actually, good question. It's actually a board that lends money to local governments in Wisconsin at low interest rates. And let me give you an example. And this is probably a high-profile example. Lambeau Field actually received a loan of around $67 million through this board in the past.
Now, what is the estimated full price tag for this big project?
Right. So, and it's going to be much more than the money that we're talking about here. The number that is being thrown around is about $500 million when it's all said and done. Now, past and present owners of the Bucks have committed something like $250 million to the project. So the question is, you know, who's going to pick up the rest of that money and how involved is the state going to be? And thusly, how much are taxpayers going to be on the hook for the final total of the construction of this arena?
So we've mentioned the state, the city, one player we haven't gotten into, the county, Milwaukee County.
Right. So County Executive Chris Abley says he is also working on a plan, at least a plan that covers the city and county's contribution. The details, though, have not been released.
All right. Well, some more fallout from the governor's budget proposal. This one we've been talking about in the past few weeks. The UW system budget. The UW system president has been speaking out over the last week or so on this.
Right. So Ray Kross continued his tour of UW campuses this week. He's been doing this tour since news of this $300 million proposed cut surfaced with the governor's budget. During a visit to UW Eau Claire this week, he conceded that there may be changes necessary for tenure around the system.
Yeah, this has been a controversy, not just in this budget, but especially since this budget came out. So talk us through the debate over tenure so far.
Right. So Governor Walker's budget essentially eliminates the statute that allows for tenure and shifts that decision-making over to a public authority, the Board of Regents. And that would essentially run the system under the governor's plan. Now, the Board of Regents is on the record supporting tenure protections, but the public authority model itself is, I would say, in limbo.
Right. So tenure is there now under state law.
Yes.
If Governor Walker's plan went through without changes, still there as run probably by the Board of Regents. But as you say, again, this is something that that Republican legislators haven't necessarily embraced. So what happens to tenure if the public authority isn't created as the governor had proposed?
Right. So if the system remains under the control of the legislature, there's really a real question as to whether these kinds of protections will last, and if so, in what form. Several key lawmakers are not big fans of the current tenure system, so a big question mark moving forward if the public authority isn't created.
So tenure, in a nutshell, a form of job protection for professors. The idea historically has been to say to make sure they have independence.
Right, academic freedom.
Study, write what they want, academic freedom. So Ray Cross, president of the UW system, what's he been saying on this tenure issue?
Right, so today, or this week at UW-Eau Claire, he said, now currently there's this post-tenure review, which happens every 5 years. But beyond that, nothing much happens. Cross would like there to be a carrot after the sort of post-tenure review and some kind of financial reward for good performance. On the other side, though, Cross says there should also be a stick. And he says faculty who aren't meeting expectations should be put on probation. And then if no improvement is made, they should be dismissed. So quite a departure from current tenure policy.
Yeah, so how would a tenured faculty member be dismissed under what's going on now?
Yeah, it's a pretty difficult and time-consuming process. Under state law, they could only be fired for what's called just cause.
And, you know, a lot of strained relationships here, the legislature and the UW, among others. How about the UW system president and the faculty?
Because obviously this is what we're talking about, the faculty. You know, tenure is a major issue for the faculty. And I would say the relationship between Cross and faculty is strained. And, you know, a lot of staff and faculty are upset with his plan that he came up with to create this public authority. They argue that the debate has really gone on without really any sort of transparency, and that this whole issue of turning over the system to this public authority just hasn't been studied enough to make such a change so quickly.
Talking to News Guide Noah Ovshinsky about the top stories in Wisconsin politics this week. Here's a new one, a proposal on regulating those rideshare app-driven things, the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world.
Right. So the State Assembly and Senate actually held hearings on the legislation that would create statewide standards for these kinds of ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft.
So why is this happening now? We've been seeing stories about these guys for a while now.
Yeah.
Around the country.
I find this to be an interesting story because it really reflects how government, which, you know, doesn't always move quickly, has to adapt to rapid changes in technology. And in just a few years, you know, these ride sharing companies have exploded, you know, aided in part by the proliferation of smartphones. And this is just an example of the state, I think, trying to, you know, keep up, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And so why a statewide standard?
Well, in the absence of any statewide regulations, local governments have had to deal with how to regulate these companies. Now, remember, these aren't traditional cab companies. These are people who use cell phone apps to find and secure transportation from drivers who are essentially private contractors, although Uber and Lyft kind of facilitate the transaction. Madison has several big companies, and this debate has been going on for more than a year about how Uber and Lyft, which are competing for customers with cab companies, how they should be regulated.
And what does this legislation do then at the state level?
So it creates rules that address licensing, safety, criminal background checks, for instance, and insurance. Supporters say it will help these companies expand and, you know, ultimately help communities that are underserved by taxis, perhaps in like more rural areas.
And this did not meet with universal agreement and approval. What have critics said about this proposal?
Right. So for some, this legislation really is an attack on local control. For instance, a gentleman who has worked for Union Cab in Madison for more than 20 years says, you know, local governments should have the ability to opt out. You know, they argue not every ride sharing experience is a good one, and that cities and towns should have the power to add more accountability if they want.
All right, we'll watch this one as it progresses through the usual procedures. Noah, thanks as always for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
It's WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky covering some of the big stories around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This week's been a rough one for Indiana. A week ago, Indiana Governor Mike Pence signed the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law, igniting a firestorm of backlash from activists and businesses and politicians. They canceled conventions, called for modifications to the law. Some boycotted the state altogether. Their concern was that the law could allow private businesses effectively to discriminate against the LGBT community. Yesterday, with the hope of stemming some of those concerns, Governor Pence signed a new measure into law that would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity under that new religious freedom law. Here with us now with the latest on the story is Brandon Smith. He's State House reporter at Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So under Indiana's original religious freedom law, there are protections apparently for discrimination for some categories. Was there ever a push to include protection for the LGBT community in the original law?
Well, in the original law, there weren't protections for any particular group. The original law simply established a judicial test, what they call a three-tier test, for when the government can infringe on a person's religious beliefs. So the original law didn't include any protections. There are protections in the Indiana State Civil Rights Statute on the basis of religion, race, gender, things like that, but not sexual orientation or gender identity.
Now, was there any sense as this original law went through that there'd be this kind of national response, as significant as it's been?
No, not this significant. There had been opposition throughout the process, the legislative process, to this bill from within the state, from the business community, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce, gay rights organizations, the ACLU here in Indiana were all opposed to it. You had law professors opposed to it and supporting it, but nothing like what we saw over the last week. This was stunning to pretty much everybody on both sides of this debate.
Now, when we hear about people canceling conventions or considering canceling conventions, it might sound like a symbolic gesture. But as I understand it, Indianapolis is a big convention town. This is a serious economic issue, especially in that city.
Absolutely. Indianapolis is a really big convention town, as is not to the same extent, but Fort Wayne up in northeast Indiana as well. And they started to see cancellations, meetings canceled. And we're talking about millions of dollars, certainly in Indianapolis, of economic impact, because it's not just, you know, it's the hotels, it's the restaurants, it's the bars downtown. There's a lot of nightlife around downtown Indianapolis that's kind of grown up around this brand new convention center that the city's had for several years now. It's a huge deal here, and it helped prompt this legislative fix that we saw yesterday.
Well, let's get into this fix. What exactly changed in this?
Well, it's legalese. That's what it comes down to. But the language that they passed yesterday says that the religious freedom law cannot be used by anyone to refuse services to anyone on the basis of race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation or gender identity. That's important because that's the first time those words have appeared in Indiana state law. Now, it's important to note that, like I mentioned earlier, the state civil rights statute doesn't have those phrases in it, which means in all but 12 Indiana cities that have human rights ordinances that bar discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, and everywhere else in Indiana, that's still legal because RFRA, as it's called, the Religious Freedom Law, had no impact on that whatsoever.
Right. So to hammer that point home a little, this does not add sexual orientation as a protected group under civil rights laws. It just says you can't discriminate based on sexual orientation on this new RFRA law, based on that.
That's absolutely correct. Although it was pointed out not only by gay rights organizations and businesses, but even the Republican legislative leaders in the General Assembly noted yesterday, as they talked about this legislative fix they were proposing, they said this is really the start of a larger conversation. This has made us think about perspectives we haven't considered before, a debate we haven't really touched at all. So the most lasting impact, perhaps, of this whole RFRA debate in Indiana will be kind of a fast-forwarding of a conversation about gay rights in this state.
Now, supporters of the original version of the law, as they said, this fix wasn't really needed. They were trying to make the case that this didn't allow discrimination. So Were the people who agreed to the fix, who had previously supported it, saying this was symbolic to address national concerns that were overblown to begin with?
They didn't use the word symbolic, but it was largely, yes, that. They said all along, people like the Republican legislative leaders, Speaker Brian Bosma, Senate President Pro Tem David Long said, there is nothing wrong with this law. It is a good law. But we understand the perception that's out there. So we are going to be explicitly clear when we say it will not be allowed to be used for discrimination. That was really what this was about. It was about sending the message, making it clear. Like I said, the only concrete thing you could argue it did is protect those 12 cities that have the human rights ordinances, protect those ordinances from any questions about whether they'd be allowed to continue under a RFRA challenge.
We're talking to Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting about a new change, a fix, it's being called, to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in that state that's gotten national attention. And Brandon, people who have criticized this law from the beginning, looking at this new fix, are they saying, okay, our work here is done, nothing to see here, everything's good now?
Most reaction hasn't been quite like that. There have been a few, notably I'd say the one that springs to mind is the NCAA had a positive statement that after the fix was passed by the General Assembly, proposed and passed by the General Assembly. It said, you know, we were very concerned and now we're okay. Most businesses, most groups say this is a good start, but this conversation isn't over, which goes back to what we talked about a second ago about the idea of fast-forwarding the gay rights conversation. It's not going to happen this year. There's only about a month left in the General Assembly's session, and they're not going to do anything in terms of making sexual orientation a protected class this year. But we will almost certainly see the debate next year.
So that's reaction from critics of that original religious freedom law. How about the supporters, the people who are behind this? Do they feel like it's been diluted in any way based on this new fix?
Oh, more than that. They talked about, they used the word dismantle in some statements yesterday. Groups like Indiana Right to Life, the pro-life movement, pro-family, quote-unquote pro-family conservative groups came out pretty vociferously against this so-called legislative fix, saying it would destroy the original law, it would undo the religious protections that they had been given only a week ago, and they called on the governor to veto it, which of course he didn't do last night. He did sign it.
And the business community within Indiana, you mentioned the Chamber of Commerce and their take on this law from the beginning. What kind of response have you heard from them since this fix passed yesterday?
So far, it's been positive. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce was one of the groups who stood behind the Republican leaders yesterday. And in this show of support from the business community, there were more than 20 business leaders standing behind them as they announced this legislative fix. So it seems like they were part of the process in crafting the legislative fix. The lawmakers met with business leaders to kind of get to a place that the business community could say, okay, we fixed it, we can move forward now. And we're starting to see that impact already. For instance, Wilco, the band Wilco, who had canceled a concert in Indianapolis in response to RFRA, has gone back and reversed that decision, will be going ahead with the concert.
Is there a sense that among people who are promoting tourism, conventions, business in general in Indiana, that they're in damage control mode now?
They were most of this week, certainly, and they're still seeking to repair that damage, absolutely, particularly in Indianapolis, which, of course, the spotlight is shining so brightly on because of the Final Four this weekend, which I know is important to you guys up here in Wisconsin. they have been working around the clock, putting new signs up all over the airports, all over the city. You know, Indy welcomes all, everyone is welcome, no discrimination here, that sort of thing. Absolutely, damage control would be a good way to describe it.
Now, you may be aware that Wisconsin has had an issue or two over the last few years that's brought about a lot of division in the state, gotten national attention here. Is this unusual for Indiana, or do you feel there's that sense of strong partisan divide there as well?
It's not that unusual. We've had a couple of particularly sharp debates over the last few years. We had our own right-to-work debate before you guys did, or around the same time you guys did back in 2012. We had our own gay marriage debate last session. last year when the Republicans tried to pass a ban against gay marriage into the state's constitution, ultimately rejected by lawmakers, and then a gay marriage battle in the court system in Indiana last year. So not a stranger to a pretty marked debate by both sides, but nothing like the national backlash that we saw over this particular debate.
And as we wrap up this brief flirt maybe with the national spotlight, do you think what happened there in Indiana is maybe sending a message to other states, Arkansas also in the spotlight now, maybe other states might hesitate before moving ahead based on this experience?
Well, in fact, I talked with a public radio station down in Georgia about this issue earlier this week, and I heard from one of the people down there that the Georgia legislature, which had been considering its own version of RFRA, seems to be pulling back from that debate entirely, for at least for this year. So I think it is causing other states to look at Indiana and go, do we really want a piece of that?
Brandon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Brandon Smith, State House reporter at Indiana Public Broadcasting, talking about Indiana's amendment to their controversial religious freedom law. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert's off today. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. You're doing it all wrong. It's not working. Stop doing it and do it differently. If you're feeling a bit defensive about my vague and unfounded criticisms, you're not alone. When we offer feedback to other people in the form of negative criticism, it can trigger that kind of defensive reaction without actually making any sort of positive change. In fact, according to our next guest, this kind of criticism actually makes us worse at our jobs, in sports, at driving, in life. And especially in the workplace, it may make it harder to create and keep a diverse workforce. Kate Heddleston joins us now. She's a writer and a software engineer. Her piece, Criticism and Ineffective Feedback, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do we mean when we say negative criticism? What kind of statements are you talking about here?
Well, criticism, it's a bit nebulous, I think, but it's the idea of giving someone negative feedback, especially feedback that doesn't have any sort of concept of how to make the behavior better. So censure, fault-finding, things like that fall into the category of criticism.
So what happens? What is the reaction when we give, and I guess when we get this kind of negative criticism?
Yeah, so when people receive criticism, and what's important to know is that criticism is usually defined by the receiver, but if someone perceives something to be critical, they respond really negatively, and our brains hyper-focus on negative events. So as soon as criticism is perceived, it kind of like blocks out everything else in our brain. So we don't remember much that was said before, much that was said after, and we just tend to focus on this negative remark. And that can have really strong implications on our behavior, on what we think of the criticizer. So we tend to really resent people who criticize us. And studies have shown that it also hurts our performance on the task that we're criticized on.
Which is pretty amazing, since that's theoretically the opposite of the goal of the criticism. You, in that piece I mentioned, you give an example of a friend in motorcycle racing. You have a tale of two coaches or pit crews, I think. Can you talk through the two different experiences there?
Yeah, this was a great story. I was talking to a friend about, we were talking about onboarding new engineers and, you know, the role of criticism. And he goes, I have a great story where I kind of learned that personally. And he started motorcycle racing a few years back. And the first year that he was racing, you know, the first year you're very vulnerable, he had a pit guy who was kind of a classic criticism person. He always told him what he was doing wrong and all the things that you know, were incorrect that he should change. And he found that it didn't actually improve his behavior. It made him a tentative rider. He got into accidents, and he really didn't like the sport. But he gave it one more year, and he changed pit guys, and the new pit guy was unfailingly positive. He was always talking about things that he could do better, but in terms of the actual behavior. He would also sometimes fiddle with my friend's bike and come out and say he'd change something, and he would certainly go faster this round. And my friend would go faster, even though he'd lied. He hadn't actually changed anything on the bike. And the second year, it was totally different. He had more experience, but he also ended up winning races. He was much happier. he felt excited about the sport, and he improved drastically as a result of that feedback and also probably his positive attitude.
Okay, so that's a fun thing, like, or fun for some, I guess, probably not for me, motorcycle racing. But in software engineering, I mean, you want people to do a program the right way and not in a way that crashes the Pentagon server or something like that. So how did, in a workplace context like that, how does this translate? How do you avoid that the negative stuff, provide that positive imagery, and get a better result?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you see the same kinds of behavior, right? You have a goal of people doing things correctly and being excited about it. And giving criticism hurts that goal. You know, people are less excited. People are more tentative. And tentative software engineers also aren't necessarily as good. You want people who are excited about what they're building and kind of, you know, building things that are new and, I guess, pushing the boundaries of what the product is. And so hindering their behavior is not the goal that you want. It also, criticism seems like it's more of the type of feedback that helps the criticizer get something off their chest than it is something that helps the person change their behavior. So pointing out something that someone is doing wrong might make you feel better as a boss or a manager, but it doesn't actually change your employee's behavior the way that you want. So I noticed it first when I was training new engineers. The biggest problem we have in software engineering is attrition. We lose engineers, and it's really expensive. And criticism is, a big problem in engineering for that. People who don't get the confidence, who feel criticized, who feel bad at their job, are more likely to leave the field. And we can't afford to lose engineers.
And we're talking now with Kate Heddleston. She's a software engineer and a writer, talking about her piece on criticism and ineffective feedback. And Kate, I wanted to focus in on that attrition in your line of work and elsewhere. You say that criticism, when we do it wrong, it disproportionately affects women and members of minorities in workplaces. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think actually the response to criticism is similar across all different types of people. We all uniformly hate it and respond really negatively. But recent studies have shown that women and potentially minorities receive more criticism in their feedback. So if people respond really horribly to criticism and certain groups are getting more criticism than others, that's a problem.
So everybody has the same negative response, but for some reason at a work site, a woman or a minority member on a job hears more of that kind of negative criticism than, I guess, their white or male counterparts.
Yeah, and it was a really interesting study done, by Kieran Snyder. She gathered reviews from, you know, over 180 people and analyzed the actual content of the reviews to find more critical feedback towards women, and especially more personal critical feedback towards women. So 76% of criticism towards women included personal criticism, whereas 2% of criticism towards men was personal in nature.
And this is an issue in your line of work, software engineering. There's been a lot of talk in that and other STEM, science, technology fields. Do you think this is a big part of the solution to having a more diverse workforce in those fields?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, attrition for any engineer is expensive. We can't lose anyone, but we're especially losing women and minorities much faster. So if women are receiving more critical feedback in engineering, then that's something that needs to change. We need to work to create environments where everyone is welcome and where we're not damaging the performance of certain groups over others.
Well, let's get into some do's and don'ts of criticism. One thing you mentioned in that example was personal criticism. So if it's, I guess, a you are statement, a universal thing about how you are bad, that's one of the problems we encounter, you say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, women are more likely to receive personal criticism, such as you are abrasive, you are being too assertive, or the one that I think was cited in the Ellen Powell trial, where she was told she needed to let other people shine. I thought that one was particularly depressing.
So that there may be a mindset beneath this that goes beyond the whole criticism issue. But if we find ourselves having a problem with a coworker, say, or an employee that is in that sort of generic, you are blank, what would be a better way to reshape, to rethink how we're going to approach them that's more goal-oriented, that might get a positive result?
Yeah, the way that I think about it is if you see a problem at work, there's usually a behavior that you want to see. So rather than criticizing what someone is doing, let them know what behavior you want them to have. So if there's something that you want someone to do in terms of process, you know, maybe they need to, I don't know, file something a certain way or fill out a form a certain way, rather than telling them that they did it wrong, just go and reiterate the way that they should do it correctly. And that will remove a huge amount of just unnecessary criticism.
I know sometimes people are frustrated doing that again and again. Like I remind person X every week to fill out the TPS report this way.
Yeah.
I mean, is it okay to be that broken record as long as we stay positive in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I don't actually think that criticizing is going to help change anything. I think to a certain degree, people are inundated with information and you have to repeat things multiple times in this day and age. So if someone... you tell someone something once and they don't do it, I don't think that criticizing them is going to fix it. You know, you have to repeat things.
And you had another example in your piece, based on your experience coaching water polo. You figured out one way you're doing things was failing and another way worked. Tell that story.
Yeah, so I did a lot of sports growing up, and I found that they were a great kind of testing ground for a lot of ideas. And when I was coaching JV girls water polo after my career was over, I found that critical feedback was really damaging. That's where this whole idea came from, actually. So I would stand on the pool deck yelling at these 14 and 15-year-old girls to, you know, like swim faster or whatever it was. And at first, I defaulted to classic critical feedback. I would yell at them whenever they did something wrong, and I'd tell them what they did wrong. And they had what I call now the deer in the headlights response, where they just would freeze. They would freeze and stare at me from the pool because, A, my criticism made them feel bad, but, B, they also didn't know what to do correctly. They were brand new to the sport. They had no idea how to throw a ball correctly, how to, you know, have a defensive position correctly. Like, it was my job to teach them that. And so I saw this response over and over again and decided, this isn't working. I'm going to try something new. So I continued yelling at them, just as loudly, actually. But I yelled what I wanted them to do. So I would yell, keep your elbow up, or keep your hips on top of the water, or shorten your stroke, or whatever it was. And the behavior change that I saw was incredible. They all did exactly what I wanted. And yes, I would have to repeat things, but usually they got to the place where I wanted them to be. And not only that, they were much happier. Even though I was still yelling, I wasn't going any easier on them. They were happier and they felt better about themselves and they knew what they needed to do in order to improve.
We're talking to Kate Heddleston about criticism and ineffective feedback, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered the wrong kind of criticism, say at work, in your personal life, on a sports team? Why didn't it work? Why didn't it help you? Or is there someone who's given you really helpful feedback, advice, support? What did they do right? How did they make a difference to your behavior, to your performance? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Kate Heddleston, talking about criticism and ineffective feedback and how we can do it better. Actually help people do their job better, do their sport better, whatever. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story from your life or your work about good or bad examples of feedback? Someone who's able to mentor or coach you or give you advice in a way that helped, that made a difference? Or if you are a coach, a boss, an HR person, a trainer, what works? What doesn't? Does pointing out the negative work, or does more of a positive approach do better for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Chris on the line in Burlington. Chris, hi.
Hi. Good Friday, everybody. I got to say, I feel like a master of both giving and receiving on this, it's, I appreciate all the information. The thing I wanted to ask about when it comes to ourselves and self-criticism, the thing to our self-dialogue, what we say to ourselves, I find that, you know, I can do both, but it's it works out a heck of a lot better when I'm not as critical on myself and give myself a break. So I was wondering what the expert had to say about that.
Chris, thanks for the call. That's interesting. We've talked on the show before about positive versus negative self-talk. Kate, do you think the same might apply when we're applying criticism to our own performance?
You know, I haven't done a ton of research on this, but I'm going to guess yes. The one thing that I saw across all of the really good athletes that I knew was like a positive self-talk almost to the point of delusion when they needed to perform well at their sport. You know, when someone gets up behind the block to swim or before they start a race, they're not criticizing themselves. They are telling themselves that they're going to be awesome, that they're going to win, that they're going to do really well. And so, yeah, I do think that speaking to yourself positively is huge. I mean, criticism, if it has such a negative effect, even coming from yourself, I don't think it's going to help with performance.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Alan with us in Lake Geneva. Alan, hi. Alan, are you there? I don't think we have Alan. All right, we'll move on to another caller. Eric is with us next in Endeavor. Eric, hi.
Hey, I have a small construction business, and I hire kids anywhere from 19 to 25, and they all seem useless to me, and I don't know how to do anything but yell at them at some points, and I almost make them cry a lot, and I know I'm a jerk. I just don't know how to deal with it otherwise.
All right, Eric, and these are people coming into this line of work without a lot of training, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm patient. I'm showing them what to do, but they just ignore what I tell them to do and do something else. Or they're on their stupid phone all day, and it just drives me insane. And after about 3 days, I just lose it. And I don't know how to do positive criticism anymore. I've lost that skill.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. Anything from your software engineering experience, Kate, that might apply, that might help Eric out?
Yeah, I think. To a certain degree, having intensity isn't necessarily a bad thing. Like, if people aren't listening, you might have to say things with more intensity. You might have to repeat things very quickly. And you might actually have to put in place some rules. You know, water polo teams, we had really strict rules around sportsmanship and things like that. And so getting people off their phones would be really good so that they're listening. I think that rules and structure are a great thing. And telling people what you want to see over and over again, even with some intensity, when they aren't listening is also a good way to approach it.
Eric, good luck with your crew there. And Kate, again, your message is not anything goes here. You're saying there is room for the boss to lay down the law and make better things happen, just maybe not in a negative framing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes people need a fire lit behind them, and that is absolutely a case that comes up. It's just that the way that it's done can have huge impacts on the actual behavior change that you see. So intensity, I think, is something that you sometimes have to bring to feedback. You know, I need to see this done now. It's really important that this is done now. But that's very different from criticism, actually, even though it's still a very intense statement.
Talking to Kate Heddleston about her piece on criticism and ineffective feedback. You can share your thoughts, your questions, maybe your advice at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you hit a busy signal, a line has opened up for you now. We'll go back to our callers. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Hello. Just a couple of comments. If we're criticizing ourselves, we need to remind ourselves that if a friend behaved that way, we might forgive them. And we need to be our own best friend and not overly criticize. I think it's helpful if people describe a situation, such as the pizza's burned, rather than you burned the pizza. And once you describe the situation, you can carry through with a consequence. Well, now we go hungry. Or you can carry through with a resolution, such as, I guess we all have to chip in now to buy a pizza. And whenever someone's dealing with people, remember you're making a memory. And I really believe it shouldn't take away severely from their self-esteem. That's it.
Interesting, Vivian. Thanks a lot. So again, there's a case there, Kate, where it's not, you know, failure without consequence or failure without correction, but failure that leads to something better in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the idea of of removing blame from the statement, too. Instead of you burn the pizza, it's just simply stating the problem, which is the pizza is burned. I think that's fantastic.
Is there, there's still got to be room, I assume, for blame somewhere along the line. If somebody consistently burns the pizza, ruins the software code, blows the job on the construction project.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's nice to not start from that point so that you can do a fair amount of due diligence to figure out exactly where blame lies. I think we are often really quick to jump on certain people and on certain types of problems without thinking through kind of what we're saying and the repercussions of that. So giving yourself time to figure out exactly where blame lies is it's always going to be a good thing.
Go back to our callers. Rishwa is with us in Green Bay. Rishwa, hi.
Hi. Good Friday. And I just wanted to share one of my experiences in my previous job. I was new to the job, and sometimes I got criticized and it was very negative, but then it kind of had a positive effect on me because I took it as a challenge, and then I was able to work on it, and then, finally I did well, and that criticism now, if I think of, really helped me in an awkward way.
Rishwa, we're kind of losing the connection here, but I think we got the gist of it. He's saying, hey, the negative criticism, I took it as a challenge, tried to rise above it and do better. So is part of this the criticism in the eye of the beholder, Kate? Is there advice we might have for people to take criticism in whatever form and run with it in a positive direction?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, criticism means wildly different things to different people. And I think what's interesting about that is that he reinterpreted the criticism as a challenge. And I wonder, if some people need a challenge to overcome, if you can just give that to them up front. So his reinterpretation of the criticism is great. Not everyone tends to do that with criticism. But yeah, there's definitely widely varying interpretations of criticism.
Rishwa, thanks a lot for that call. Kate, I think probably a lot of us maybe have developed habits of negative criticism. We may have developed those habits over years, even decades. Is it easy to retrain ourselves to frame our feedback in a more positive way that gets better outcomes?
I mean, it's really difficult to change your own behavior. It took me 3 years coaching to remove the words no and don't from my vocabulary. And I probably slid back a little bit. But I have to say, it's really fun because the response that you get from issuing more actionable feedback and seeing people grow and change and respond to what you say is so much fun.
And what's the response been since you put out this piece from your colleagues and your readers? Are people buying this or are they saying, no, Kate, you're wrong, don't say that?
The feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. I think most people are in the same boat. They've received negative feedback, criticism, and they were like, it was terrible and I really didn't like it. There's a few people mostly people who are managers, who think that criticism can be used sometimes effectively in the workplace, although I do question that because no one's given me a very good example of it working. but I mean, I think like there's so many different ways to give feedback. There's not just declarative feedback. There's also questions. There's positive feedback. There's teasing, which is actually a type of feedback that some managers use. So there's just a lot of different ways to interact with people.
We'll leave it there for now. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Kate Heddleston. She's a writer, a software engineer. The piece we've been talking about, she wrote, it's called Criticism and Ineffective Feedback. You can read it. It's linked on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back on Monday. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.